Welcome to the Doctor Who podcast from Castorbras. My name is Christian Corley, and with me this week is James McLean, and we're also happy to welcome Gareth Cavanagh to the show. This week, we are discussing the big topic of the week. Has Hugh Grant been cast as Doctor Who number 14? It's the latest tabloid rumour to take the frankly bored Doctor Who fan community online by storm. And while it seems pretty unlikely, perhaps there is something in it. It's difficult to say. Hugh Grant, eh?
Hugh Grant.
Well,
this is isn't it? That font of Doctor Who knowledge.
Yes. No, but I'm not sure which paper it's from, but yeah.
The Mirror have always had a decent Doctor Who snout. You know, they seem to have a really good record on Scoop, so they've obviously got someone that they speak to in the pub, down a spinning class or whatever it is, and what they get told is really good. The people, I mean, I think Hugh Grant would have been stunning in 2005.
Yeah.
23, I'm not so sure.
It's a bit, I mean, he's older than Capaldi, isn't he?
Oh, God, when you put it in that context, yeah.
Yeah. So, oh, I mean, then again, I mean, David Tennant's knocking Capaldi's age, isn't he? I mean, he's not quite as old, but...
We're all knocking Capaldi.
Yes.
You know, the days when we could guarantee to be younger than the Doctor have long passed us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they passed us in 2010, I think.
Well, I'll tell you the popular theory that I keep hearing is, obviously, I mean, it's no secret because it's there in the bookies, is Tania Miller. And the reason that I think the theory's got credence is the person who brought it up again to me, who I'll spare their name, said Russell has a habit of hiding things in plain sight in his work for his choices. And I went, okay. He said, so that novelization of Rose where he talks about the Doctor as a bald black woman with a flaming sword, he said, well, that's Tania Miller. I thought, bloody hell, you're about right. And she's got the right profile, stunning look, very high quality, and Russell's already worked with her. Mm-hmm. And he's stuck this little Easter egg into the Rose book. So, yeah, that's where I'll be putting my virtual grotsits, I think.
It's interesting. He's not the only one who does that, of course. If we cast our minds back to one of the Doctor Who... have I got it here? You know, there was that time during the Moffat era where there's lots of high-profile names were writing Doctor Who original novels. Hmm. And one of them, and I can't remember who it was, but it was a really big-name writer, there was the stories, the Third Doctor story, which featured the Third Doctor and the Master, and it had a future Master, which was basically a description of Michelle Gomez. So Moffat was obviously playing that game as well. Yeah, it's interesting to think. They're also talking about this sort of MCU angle on Doctor Who, but it's something we've already spoken about before, both with Gareth and both with myself and James. It seems to be almost sort of a default now, doesn't it?
I don't see any point in bringing it back. I mean, if you can only make the Master show every 18 months or 2 years, that's okay if you've got these other series to fill in the same way. We're not really that bothered if you only get an Iron Man film every 3 years because you've got all the other films in between and then you'll have a nice big movie-style event to bring it all together. I'm pretty happy with that.
Yeah,
I'm not sure who the spin-offs would be, though, which I think is the interesting bit. So I think the spin-offs are all going to be brand new, which is quite exciting. Much as I like to think we'd get a Master spin-off, I think that this could be something brand new, which is exciting.
I was reading earlier on today that all the old Netflix shows, the Marvel Netflix shows, are moving to Disney.
Yeah, well, that was always going to happen.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it just shows sort of like the legs and depth that it's got. But also, a lot of those shows are only sort of, I mean, I know there's ones that aren't, but the more recent Marvel shows are all sort of 8 episodes long. Which I suppose if you're doing multiple shows within the same universe, I mean, that's a justification for shortening a Doctor Who series down to 8 episodes, and then your spin-off's 8 episodes, spin-off number 2's 8 episodes, doesn't it?
I think what is interesting, what Disney have done, is how they're mixing, and I imagine this is fluid as well, sort of limited series with ongoing series. So you have WandaVision, which, as far as I'm aware, was always set out to be one season, which would kickstart off their new process of narrative onto multiverses. But Loki was always planned to do more. So that's a very good model, because it means you can drop in an eight episode limited series on Unit, which is never meant to have legs to go on for 4 years or 5 years, but is there for a specific reason to either introduce characters or to test characters or to test areas. And that kind of gives you scope, because you're not always having to think about, does this series have to have financial legs to last 2, 3, 4, 5 years? Like, no, it's just now. But it can do that because it exists and floats within a franchise, which can sustain it even if it makes a loss. If it does what it's meant to do in terms of your overall scope and draws people, helps draw people in perhaps from different angles, it can work in a different way to how broadcast television worked. So it could be interesting if they do adopt that sort of approach.
I think it lets you attack different bits of the franchise base.
Yeah. So,
you know, Star Wars has done that really well, I think. So The Mandalorian is squarely aimed, as far as I can see, at sort of grumpy old men over the age of 40 who want a bit of proper Star Trek. No, proper Star Trek. Proper Star Wars, like it used to be in olden days.
But I think Mandalorian was more smart than that, because of the use of the Grogu. That tapped into a lot younger audience as well, where I think Boba Fett has struggled because it doesn't have that ability. And I think that is, as you say, very much aimed at a 40-plus audience. And it may also indicate that the genre itself doesn't have legs. That Mandalorian itself is interesting in itself, but as soon as you replicate it in a certain way in Boba Fett, it doesn't carry that same attention.
But I enjoyed Boba Fett.
I did as well.
You know, we'll come to this again, Omega and Omega, in a minute. But I always think it's Boba Fett.
I grew up with Boba. Boba is the stuff I've learned over the last 2 years. It's taken a lot of time. I was bloody proud that I managed to say Boba Fett. I was really pleased. And now I've had to unravel all that and admit that that was just a real attempt to be right.
Down with the kids.
Down with the kids.
Yeah. I really enjoyed it. I didn't mind that it became the sort of Mandalorian 3.1. I thought the Luke, deep fake Luke, was impressive. The King Kong Sarlacc was, you know, not Sarlacc, the King Kong, God, what's the great big beast? Rancor. Wow, loved that. So there was a lot to enjoy that. The only thing that took me out the moment was right at the end, when Boba, I'm sticking with Boba because I'm old school. I bought the figures first time round. I've earned that right. Mm-hmm. And when he took his helmet off and he was smiling as like the king of the people, he had these horrific Hollywood turkey teeth. And suddenly, you watch it, suddenly I was out at the moment. I thought, he wouldn't have teeth that good. It just doesn't feel likely. So down several million points for the teeth.
I think, I know we're getting a bit off track, but something with, and I'm going to go with Boba, because to be fair, Han Solo does call him Boba in Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
It's Boba Fett. I wondered, and this comes back down to production, does tie into this idea of what you can do when you have this, you have a sort of multi-franchise franchise, a super franchise, is I still think that Mandalorian, I reckon those two, the episodes where the Mandalorian appears, I just get a feeling that they were actually the front end of the Mandalorian show, which has been drawn into it. Because if you watch Boba Fett, the way it's dropped in, if you take that out and you adjust some of the scenes around that, it doesn't need to be there. It almost feels like there was a point when they were working on Boba Fett where they felt, we need to draw some of this stuff into here and we will tap it in. And it feels tapped in. It doesn't feel, even down to the way that it's produced, the cinematography, it doesn't feel like it's done for the same show. And it kind of feels like, to me, is as if there's a point where the Mandalorian would have been in it in some way, but the story wouldn't have been there, and that the Marshal would have taken Boba Fett's place in the end battle, which would have made more sense. Because the Boba Fett show, to me, I always felt like the key pitch of it is that it's local. Everything is local in Tatooine, and it would make more sense that Boba would draw upon the Marshal to sort of tie into Tatooine coming together than he would tie in to The Mandalorian, who is not connected to Tatooine. And as I just say, the way that it sort of sews into the Mandalorian bits, it feels to me almost like there's a last minute decision to see if we can hem this in here and then rewrite the last episode or so to fit in with that. I could be wrong, but when I was watching it, it felt like that. And but you can do that sort of thing if you're doing stuff almost back to back and you own the whole bloody stuff. You can do that sort of stitching, which you've never been able to do before.
No.
So I think, again, that's interesting and could be interesting in Doctor Who if they did do that approach.
It is totally uneven, I'll give you that. You see, I really enjoyed the kind of Dances with Wolves stuff with him and the Tusken Raiders. I thought that, you know, that was great. And there was a sense to that because you have to see him getting out of the Sarlacc to have any credibility, I guess, if you're setting it on Tatooine. That's fair. And then it goes from this quite spiritual man called horse thing, you know, into a smash bang wallop, you know, ride me rancor around around Mos Eisley or Mos Espa. I get confused. And I thought, and I enjoyed it all, but now we're discussing it. Yeah, I can see that it is a little bit of a, it's a bit kind of stitched together in a way that is surprising. Because there was some lovely stuff, but I did enjoy it. Apart from
so did I.
You know, the
but there was a bit of me that I could not see them signing off on a show which runs, and then an episode 4 turns into a totally different show for 2 episodes, and then goes back to the main show. That shift just does not feel professional to me. It feels like something's happened post initial idea. It's really weird, and you don't see that much, and that's because we're in a different era now. The super franchises, and with the multiverses being done by DC and Marvel, they're now demonstrating how this can work. And I reckon you're right. I think it will co-opt. It's got to.
Yes, no. I mean, I suppose the closest thing to it was with those, you know, with the Netflix era Marvel spin-offs.
Yeah.
They were all pretty good, but there was one that I remember being pretty dreadful, and I can't remember the name, which is...
Iron Fist.
Well, Iron Fist was poor, but it's the one where they brought Iron Fist, Daredevil...
Defenders.
Yeah, Defenders. And I still couldn't get a grasp as to whose story it actually was. It was an ensemble story, but the ensemble didn't feel real or coherent. And it didn't know whose story it was, and that's by far the weakest. Although Iron Fist is pretty weak as well. That one is the weakest of the lot. So interesting. Nobody's talking about Danny Rand coming back to Disney, are they?
I think, again, it's one of those things where the struggle between the realism and the fiction, especially with superheroes, and to do low budget or lowish budget, Netflix opted to go for realism. So you self-contained their worlds to create that sort of feeling of realism in each of their worlds. Jessica Jones's Daredevils felt different. Put them all together and suddenly it doesn't feel real anymore, because it doesn't feel like these sort of realistic characters would do this. And a lot of that show felt like people trying to justify why these very different and very antisocial sort of characters would come together in a way that would work in a comic book or in a sort of hyper real world as Marvel does. Yeah, I agree, it didn't work. But
So to bring this back to Doctor Who, lest we lose our core listenership of 3, who've tuned in here.
Two now. Two, yes. Yeah.
So we're back. Have you stopped listening, Christian?
what would if you were doing the spin-offs, let's say you've got 3 spin-offs to do alongside Doctor Who, what are you doing? What are you pitching to Russell?
That's a really good question, isn't it? Incredible. Sort of question that we could have been good for us to decide beforehand and done research and then come back to, but we don't work like that. We work off the cuff. There's no dailies or anything like that. Dailies here, there's just us. I mean, I think one of the things I would probably jump to would be, because it's popular, I think you'd have to try and do something, a limited series with McGann. I think that might have legs within the fan base. I don't think it would be necessarily something which would have the legs that the fan base think it would have, if that makes sense. Mm. I think I would probably do something like that, but it's a good point. I'm not entirely sure.
What are the obvious things? And nothing's jumping. Actually, I don't think UNIT works. Not now, because we're in a kind of post-military pomp phase.
Yes.
I can't think of a single drama in that space that celebrates sort of military derring do, especially, you know, as the closest thing we've got, you know, with Russia shooting bits of Ukraine to pieces.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I totally agree.
A World War II thing might work.
The what?
A World War II thing might work.
Ooh, sort of historic.
Yeah.
With what brigadier?
Maybe with a young brigadier. I never thought of that. I was thinking along sort of Captain America, Agent Carter sort of lines.
I think that's what you'd have to do. You'd have to look and see what can we tap into in the current markets, which is successful, that sits or could be situated within the material which exists within, or the potential material within Doctor Who.
I don't think it's as easy as we think. You see, now we're talking. Yeah. The problem with Doctor Who is it's still, you know, in the classic sense, but now it's still being made as movie of the week, and those characters are born and then they're discarded. And there's really no one, you know, no one really had a sort of recurring theme apart from UNIT. And UNIT now is not UNIT then, because the world now is not the world then. I mean, nobody's really clamoring for Torchwood to come back, I suspect. And, you know, obviously with Barrowman being out of favour, that's, you know, that's had its moment, that's gone.
But this has always been the problem with Doctor Who compared, like in role-playing games, is a Doctor Who significantly struggled because there was no world. The only world you have is the Doctor, the TARDIS, Gallifrey to push, and Skyro, really. You know, there is no sense of world to build characters outside of being a whimsical, crazy Victorian gentleman in a crazy police box. And how many can you have of those? And so it does struggle for that. I totally agree. It does struggle because it can't create that cohesive world, because it is a world of everything. You know, it's not 24th century space.
Now, I always thought it was strange that Russell didn't actually do Rose Tyler, Earth Defender, because as the spin-off ideas went, I always thought that was the strongest. You know, Billy Piper had a strong following, was quality, was well-loved as a character, was seen as the equal of the Doctor. And he'd already set it up by dumping in her own universe. I guess something with the Daleks has probably got legs.
Yeah.
But I'm not quite sure what that legs would be.
I mean, I would do one on a rogue Cyberman, a bit like going back to the old Alan Moore stuff. But I'd like the idea of tapping into something like the Mandalorian vein, but with a rogue Cyberman could be quite interesting.
Oh, that's good.
That's good. That's one. Okay. Do we think the Master could sustain his own series?
Well, he can on the radio. The radio, listen to me, the old timer on Big Wild Finish.
Yeah, no, I think a wireless radio master would work. I think the Master's got legs.
Yeah,
I mean, again, you, I suppose
they've all got legs, apart from Davros.
We could look at Big Finish and sort of say, "Oh, what's Big Finish done?" And obviously, a lot of that to some people is a bit of a joke, to the level that they will unearth treats from the franchises. But I think some of their stuff has been there have been some quite interesting moves. Yeah, I suppose, again, it depends on who you're targeting as well, isn't it? I mean, this is where people don't seem to understand, is you just can't transpose Big Finish into...
Okay,
screen.
I've got it. So Downton Abbey, but on Gallifrey.
Well, not bad. So more work required is what we're saying.
A very big thank you to Gareth Cavanagh for joining us this week on the Casterbus Doctor Who podcast. I'm happy to say that Gareth will be back next week, in which he will be talking at length about cutaway comics, his trip to Gallifrey 1, and also a trip to Oldbourne to savour the location where the classic Third Doctor serial, The Demons, was filmed. Until then, it's goodbye from us.